Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear umami ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a bit of mystery for many people, and I'd like to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Rick Smith, who is the owner of Sakaya in East Village, the only sake-specialized retail shop in the East Coast, which he runs with his wife and co-owner Hiroko Furukawa. Hello and welcome to the show.
Thanks, Akiko-san. Good to be here.
So sake has become very popular in the U.S., and you can even see sake on wine lists at non-Japanese restaurants such as 11 Madison Park, Le Bernardin, per se, and other Michelin-starred restaurants. But I think most people don't know much about sake. So can you please tell us what sake is first?
Sure. Sake is a brewed beverage, actually. It's brewed like beer, but premium sake, which we sell, drinks like fine wine. So it's made from four basic ingredients: rice, water, yeast, and something called koji, which is necessary for fermentation. It's also used in things like miso and shoyu or soy sauce. It's always made from those four basic ingredients, and it's brewed, as I say, but the brewing process is a little different than it is for, say, beer. We can talk about that when
okay.
We don't want to get too geeky here, maybe right away.
Well, there's one thing I wanted to mention about water. I heard it's 90% of sake.
That's right. Yeah, right? It's predominantly water. And water is important to each and every sake, too, because each brewer has its own unique water source, which differentiates a sake from any of the others that are out there.
Okay. Like terroir, the wine term.
A little bit, yeah. The water is probably the closest thing to what, you know, terroir is to wine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that reminds me. One time I went to a brewery in Hiroshima, and they've been making sake for a long time. And he said, the owner said, he has a well, and that's the source of their water for making sake. And there's a mountain nearby, and he said it takes 15 years for the water to reach from the top of the mountain to his well. So, like, contains a lot of minerals and everything throughout the mountain.
That journey has everything to do with the way that sake tastes, too.
Okay. And so the mold, that's the koji, that's the mystery thing?
Yeah, I think a lot of people, you know, have not heard of koji before, but koji is actually something that's it's rice that's actually inoculated with a mold called koji kin. And there are different types of koji kin, but for sake, or nihonshu as it's called in Japan, the primary type of koji used is yellow koji. But you'll see koji, different types of koji used to make different types of fermented products, as I mentioned before, and also different types of alcoholic beverages. But with sake, it's yellow koji.
Right. So the koji and the yeast add some flavors, and then the rice. Rice is, can we think that the rice is like grapes?
You can. And as with wine, eating rice is different from sake brewing rice.
Right, like grapes, you don't eat wine making grapes because it's too acidic.
Yeah, and you have, you know, there are certain grapes that are only used for making wine and certain grapes that are only eaten, and the same holds true for rice. Although there are sake made from eating rice, but primarily sake rice or sakamai varieties are used to make sake, and there are many, many, many different sake rice varietals too, just as there are many different wine grape varietals.
Mm. Well, it sounds like sake only four ingredients, and it sounds very natural beverage.
Yes, I mean there's it's all everything that goes into it. There's no artificial ingredients whatsoever used in making sake.
Great. And so the production method, I know that the wine has to the wine sugar is converted straight to alcohol in case of wine, and then because sake is made from grain, you have to convert the starch to sugar and then alcohol, so there are two steps.
And that's exactly what the role of koji is. Koji is needed to break down the starch in the rice part of the mix of ingredients into those sugars so that the yeast can eat those sugars and fermentation can occur.
Mm. Okay. And the difference between beer and the sake, they are both grain-based and fermented. So what's the difference?
Well, beer making, again, not getting too much into the detail, but beer brewing is a sequential process. One step follows the other. But with sake brewing, there are several steps taking place at the same time in the same tank, and that is specifically the conversion of that starch into sugar and then the yeast acting upon it to create, you know, alcohol and carbon dioxide. So those two things happen at the same time in the same tank, and that's called multiple parallel fermentation. Mm-hmm. With beer, those things take place separately and are done individually in sequence, as I mentioned.
Right. Oh, that's why I heard that there are a lot of byproducts from making sake, and then that leads to more flavors. And I was reading an article that byproducts can produce extra flavors, like taste elements. And compared to other beverage, whiskey and brandy has 400 elements, and wine 600. And sake is 700 to 1200. So it should be more tasty, in theory.
Yeah, I mean, I've never heard that that information before, but there are as many different sake as you can imagine. I mean, everyone seems, I think the old conception of sake, or many people, or the conception of sake that I had before I was introduced to premium sake, which is what we sell at our shop, was that it was, you know, high in alcohol, always served hot, and you tossed it back like a shot of low-grade distilled spirit. But in fact, these things are very complex and have all the characteristics that, you know, that great wines have.
Mm. So that, you know, the warm sake, high alcohol, because there used to be, I think, in this country, the quality was so bad that you have to warm it up to get the flavor out. And it's a guaranteed recipe for headache and sickness next day, kind of. Right.
And that's also because people just threw it back, as I say, like a shot, and they drank. It goes right to the brain when it's, A, because it's warmed, and B, because you're imbibing something that has, in the case of the low-grade sake, a lot of extra added alcohol. Premium sake generally range in alcohol content from 15 to 17%, which mm-hmm. is higher than wine, but not, you know, higher. There are certain wines that are that high in alcohol as well. So it's not, many people have the idea that sake is very high in alcohol, but I think it's because they're thinking of those things that, you know, we were just talking about, the low grade things that were drunk quickly and drunk hot. And
So what changed the market in terms of, you know, more higher premium sake is available in Japan and here too?
Yeah, I think, a few things have gone on, but I think, you know, in the United States, the appreciation for wine has changed quite a bit over the last 20 to 30 years. And I think, you know, that sort of track exists as well for premium sake. And I think people who are into wine have discovered that, you know, hey, here's another, as I did, in fact, is... here's another beverage that has, you know, all that sort of, you know, interest and complexity and intrigue and, you know, variety and, you know, that you know, stimulates that kind of, you know, appreciation. And also it's I think a beverage that, you know, people have misunderstood for quite some time. So when they taste something that's really, you know, wonderful, they go, wow, this is not what I thought it was. I got to dig a little more deeply into this.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense because they're more expensive Japanese restaurants, especially since Nobu started becoming popular in the 80s. And then high-end, sophisticated Japanese cuisine is my almost like status symbol. And I think Masa in Taimawana building in New York, it's, your check average can be $600 per person. And so is sake. Right? But you don't have to pay that much for sake.
You definitely don't. There are, I mean, again, it's all a matter of personal preference, too. I mean, there are sake to appeal to every different taste that, you know, people might have. Or for one person, you might desire something at one time that you know, in a different sake at another time. It's all a matter of, as we like to say, of the mood, the food, the time, the place, the time of day,
right.
The season, all those things, you know, can play into it. And you can drink something that responds to that inclination and never duplicate.
So now your personal, you know, how did you get into sake then?
Yeah. Well, it was as I was sort of alluding to a minute ago, and that is I was a wine enthusiast for a long time, and about 18 years ago, at the time I was the associate publisher of Food and Wine magazine, and we had written a story about the opening of a new sushi restaurant in the East Village called Jewel Bako, which is still there today.
Mm-hmm.
But to bring that story a lot to life, we took a group of our clients to there for dinner, and we were offered sake to go with our dinner, and I said, no way, I don't want that hot jet fuel. and the owner said, no, wait, we have premium sake, it's fine, it's like a fine wine. I'm like, come on, you're kidding me. He says, no, like, here, we'll pour some for you to try. And sure enough, like, that was the aha moment for me. I was stunned, you know, to find that sake or premium sake had all the attractive qualities that made me such a wine fan. So I delved more deeply into it and started looking for places to buy it and to try it and to talk to people about it. And there really weren't many places in New York.
Do you remember what kind of addition sake you had at the time?
I actually do, and it's kind of funny because the name is something, well, in Japanese it's Onino Shiroburui, which means devil's quivering tongue, loosely translated. So when you hear that, you don't forget it very easily. And I since met I've been to the brewery where that sake is made, and, you know, in the last several years, and I always tell them that story too. They get a kick out of it.
Right. I'm sure your tongue was quivering too. okay,
and it's, and by the way, it's not right. It's not a it's a good sake. It's not a great sake. It's sort of an everyday type of brew, but but it was markedly better than anything I had had up until that point. So it was really a great sort of toe in the water to get, you know, to start my exploration into, you know, what was out there.
Right. And then you decided to open a sake shop, which is a big jump. Rather than just staying as a big lover of sake, what made you to decide?
Well,
to open it?
My wife Hiroko and I found that in our search to, you know, try all these things and learn about them, that there was really no place in New York where, I mean, there were places that sold sake, and there's a large market in New Jersey that sells pretty big variety of them, but there still was nobody there that could answer your questions or teach you or guide you.
Mm-hmm.
So we did most of that on our own, but there was and still is the first sake-only shop in the United States in San Francisco called True Sake, and I had been there and for my work
at Food and Wine.
Bo Timken.
Right. He's very famous on the West Coast.
Yeah. He's famous everywhere because he's a sake zealot. And he was really helpful to us in getting started. And but I met him when I first, you know, had my aha moment and walked into his shop, and it was just, he was there alone. It was, you know, they were fairly new at that point, and he helped me understand a little bit more, and I thought, you know, it's just it's wild that there's a place in San Francisco like this, but there is no such place in New York, a much bigger city with like 8 to 10 times the population, and certainly, you know, a place where people are always adventurous and curious and looking to learn about new things or to delve into things more deeply. And I thought what a opportunity it would be to create something like this in a place that where the reception would have to be, you know, as good as at least it was in San Francisco.
Right. So, but I'm sure it was, you know, you needed the courage to quit your job and open a place.
Well, it was, yeah, it wasn't, in you know, as time has gone on, that little time frame feels like it got compressed a little bit, but actually it was several years between the time that you know, I actually first tried this and when we, you know, we opened our shop in December 2007, and it was probably 2000, well, it was around 2000 that I first had the sake experience that changed my direction. But and during the course of that time, we were trying things and learning and so forth. So, yeah, it took some time, and then we were, neither one of us had any experience with opening a shop or so we had to we had a lot of help and a lot of great, you know, people to draw as a resource. But we've now been open almost 8 years.
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
And so how many types of sake, how many labels do you carry?
We have about 140 different sake labels. That's we do things a little differently too. We don't we focus very closely on the smaller producers. They would be like the craft or micro brewers in the beer world, you could say.
But also I wanted to mention, you know, the sake industry in Japan is actually kind of being declining, and probably because people stop drinking sake, you know, there's no corporate, big corporate accounts, or younger generations not drinking much sake, but we have to support them, so someone like you is doing it, it's great.
Well, that's, yeah, and that's what our mission and that of the mission of all of us here in the United States who are promote and encourage people to try sake. I mean, it's, and it, one of the important things too is that we're supporting those brewers, but we're also supporting, you know, a Japanese tradition, and we're also a means of for people to learn about Japanese culture. Since once they get into sake, you know, your sort of your field of interest starts to expand, because you realize that this beverage, you know, comes from a place where it has a long and valued history, and it touches in a lot of areas of Japanese life and Japanese culture. So the more you learn about sake, the more you learn about Japan.
It's almost purely craftsman, like when it comes to very high-end sake, really handmade, and people has been doing it. I met a guy who was 19th generation, and his family, whole family, doing it for 5 centuries or something. And
yeah, there are, and that's we kind of like, you open your eyes when you hear something like that. But there, and it's not uncommon to have families there that have been in this business for, as you say, 19. There's a family in Ibaraki Prefecture that that make a sake called Sato no Homare. It's a Junmai Ginjo sake. They make others, of course, too. But the name of the brewer is Sudo Honke, and they have been in business for 55 generations. That's so just like...
What was American then?
How can you, like... I think it takes you back to, like, the year 800 or something. Needless to say, the sake is not the same as it was then.
So, at your store, who are buying you the sake?
You know, it's funny because we have a lot of people say, well, who is your typical customer? And there is no such thing. Our customers are as diverse as the city of New York and its visitors. And in fact, it's diverse as the United States, because we ship all over the country. And we have people ordering from us from every state that allows it. But just as, I mean, just imagine, you know, the city and all the different types of people that live here and come here to visit, and those are the people who walk through our doors and actually, you know, buy from us. We have regular customers from, you know, Brazil and from from Europe and from Mexico and Canada, and they come regularly, year after year. I mean, it's not just a, the occasional stop in, oh, here's a sake shop, buy a bottle of sake.
Oh,
I mean,
wow.
They come back and they buy, you know, to meet their needs every year.
Because there's no other sake-only shop in the West Coast, the East Coast. And
where there are only four in the entire country, and the other three are in the West Coast, and there's one in Hawaii.
Okay.
And the other two are True Sake, which we mentioned, in a place in Seattle called Sake Nomi.
Okay.
And then it's easy to remember the name of the place in Hawaii because it's called the Sake Shop, which is what our name means in Japanese, Sakaya.
Yeah. Yeah. Probably that's more authentic. Right. So now we're taking a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk about the flavors and food pairings about sake. So please stay with us.
Region. Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. My guest today is Rick Smith, the owner of Sakaya, a sake-only retail shop in East Village. So we've been talking about sake and what you sell at Sakaya. So let's talk about how to drink it. The flavors, I think we didn't talk about how, you know, the rice is processed. So sake rice, a grain is milled down. So that's maybe right. You can talk about that.
Sure, absolutely. The sake rice, as we were saying before, is different from eating rice, and one of the main differences is that the starch in sake rice is concentrated in the core of the grain, whereas with eating rice it's sort of diffused throughout. But surrounding that core of starch in the sake rice are vitamins, fats, proteins, things that influence that produce flavor. So the rice is milled to produce a particular flavor profile, although the other elements in making sake also contribute to it. But the outer part of that rice grain, the more of that that's milled away or polished away, the more refined the flavor of the sake, the higher the grade of the sake, which in premium sake there are grades predicated on the rice milling rates.
Because outer side is flavors, it doesn't necessarily mean that the more milled down, the better.
That's right. A lot of people mistake that, make that, you know, draw that conclusion, and you're absolutely right, because it just means that the sake that have less highly milled rice have more flavor, and they tend to be the sake actually that go well with more fully flavored foods. So they tend to have more umami, in fact, you know, that sort of that flavor characteristic that is so prevalent in many Japanese foods.
I actually see the less milled down sake to me is like red wine when it comes to pairings, because the richer the flavor. You can pair less milled sake even with meat or chicken, that kind of heavier ingredients.
Absolutely. Or with pizza. Or with, you know, red pasta sauce or things that, you know, aren't necessarily Japanese, but and that's one of the things that we try to encourage at our shop too, is that, you know, pairing sake with not just Japanese or even just Asian food, but with food from all over the world, because it actually works.
Right. So the, you know, listeners who haven't tried sake, so what's the less milled type and more milled type? Can you just name some?
Yeah, the the name for the grade of the less milled type is Junmai, or
which means pure rice.
Which means pure rice, or it's and there's a counterpart to Junmai called Honjozo, which means same milling rate but different, or has a little bit of alcohol added when making the sake. Mm-hmm. And the reason for the addition of the alcohol, by the way, is not to increase the alcohol content, but to draw out a particular flavor or aromatic quality in the mm-hmm. sake. So as you, Junmai or Junmaishu or Honjozo have fuller flavors. Mm-hmm. And, there's a whole universe of different flavor profiles within mm-hmm. that, but they go very well with the kinds of foods we were talking about, meats and poultry and roasted and braised things and so forth.
Right. So the difference between Junmai and Honjozo, the Honjozo is smoother because more alcohol, the sake is added? Or?
It's hard to generalize because, it sort of depends on the individual sake, but you could say that they might be a little bit drier sometimes, have a little bit more of a drier finish. Mm-hmm. They might be a little more aromatic, because the addition alcohol being more soluble in water draws out characteristics like aromas in a particular sake, depending upon the yeast that's used and so forth. But
of course, depending on which brewery, you're going to have different flavors.
There are also sake called Yamahai and Kimoto, mm-hmm. which are sake that are made by two older brewing processes. And I won't go into those details either, except to say that the result is that these are sake that have a little bit earthier flavors, a little bit more acidity to them, a little bit more bolder flavors, again, that tend to match up very well with food and with things like cheeses, or again, like the pizzas I mentioned before, or with tomatoes, things that have umami in them also. Mm. They just pair up so well. So Yamahai and Kimoto sake, within that, particularly the realm of Junmai, mm-hmm. have really great food pairing qualities to them.
Because it's more umami elements, it's easier to pair with other umami elements.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. And so what's the more milled down sake?
As you use more and more highly milled rice, you get, more delicate and complex types of flavor profiles. The next level above Junmai and Honjozo would be Junmai Ginjo and Ginjo for no alcohol added and alcohol mm-hmm. added.
So when you say Junmai, it means pure rice. And then
Junmai, anytime you see the term Junmai, it always means no alcohol added mm-hmm. or pure rice.
Oh, okay.
And at the top grade, there's Junmai Daiginjo and Daiginjo, which is the super premium sake that's the most expensive, but it's also the most complex and the most made in much smaller quantities and mm-hmm. more handcrafted and higher quality ingredients, and hence are more expensive and might be analogous to, let's say, Grand Cru wines.
And delicate.
Some are very delicate. Others, might have a little bolder, intense sorts of flavor profiles too. Oh. But they tend to be more complex. They tend to have more layers to them. Mm-hmm. But that's again one of the great things about sake is that there are exceptions to everything.
Oh. So you have to learn by drinking a little more.
Exactly, the best way.
Right. Okay, so now, how do you describe the flavors of sake?
Yeah, it's a challenge, I think. We try to explain them in our shop in terms that people are familiar with. So they tend to be terms that relate to wine, but there are certain flavor components or aromatic qualities to sake that, you don't necessarily find in the wine vernacular. So we draw on elements that are things that are like those flavors, because we're always trying to demystify and make these things more accessible. So we won't, even the term umami, which we've been throwing around here because we both know what it means, mm-hmm. Not everybody that comes into the shop understands that concept. Mm-hmm. But if you say it's what makes, Parmesan Reggiano taste mm-hmm. Certain types of cured meats or mushrooms, or mm-hmm. it's the element that distinguishes those flavors, then people go, aha, okay, now I see. So we try to use those terms, you know, things that people can relate to from their other life experiences that haven't necessarily included sake, mm-hmm. to bring them closer to understanding what these things taste like.
Mm. So, but I think, you know, there's a measurement, right, to be able to guess. Usually in the back mm-hmm. label, there's a kind of chart.
There are. Sometimes, you know, it's one of the things that's that probably could use a little bit more help in the world of sake, and that is the labels. But, there's certain what you might call vital statistics, you mm-hmm. know, about each sake that would be the milling rate of the rice and something called SMV or sake meter value, which mm-hmm. is a statistical indicator of sweetness or dryness. So the mm-hmm. higher the number of the SMV, the drier the sake. Mm.
I heard that the plus 5 and above tend to be dry.
It's hard to really, again, like generalize, but I would even go further. I would say plus 10 or above, mm-hmm. or plus 8 or above maybe. But again, you know, the dryness, the perception of dryness or sweetness can be influenced by other factors in the sake. Mm. So it's hard to just, you know, use the numbers for when it comes to SMV. Mm. And we try to steer people away from just using that alone. But if you, as we were saying a minute ago, if you drink a lot of sake, and that's mm-hmm. the best way to learn, then you'll start to know that, oh, I understand now that, you know, a plus 10 in this with a light-bodied sake is going to be very different from it might taste drier than a plus 8 with a fuller-bodied sake,
mm.
or plus 12 with a fuller-bodied sake, should say.
Okay, and I heard also there's an acid degree. It's called the Sando and amino acid degree. That means acidity mm-hmm. that affects how you perceive sweetness. And amino acid degree is kind of measuring protein, like umami elements.
Yeah, and those you don't always see on the labels, unfortunately. Those you have to dig a little deeper for in many cases. There are certain importers or distributors put those on their labels, but not so many. Mm. If you can read Japanese, you can go to the website of the sake brewer and find that information, which is what we do.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not always so readily available. But again, that's the sort of, yeah, those are terms along with the milling rate, the sake meter value, or the Nihon Shudo, as it's known in Japanese, and that can guide you a little bit. And then there's also, of course, the alcohol content.
Mm-hmm.
And with regard to that, actually, there's an important thing to kind of remember and that's the term genshu. Mm. Most sake, when sake is brewed, is made at the end of the process, after pressing, is diluted with water to bring the alcohol content down to about 15 to 17%. If it's not diluted, that's when the term genshu is used to describe the sake. So mm-hmm. an undiluted sake that is undiluted, usually, but not always, has higher alcohol content.
Like?
Can be, you know, 18 to 20. Wow. I have one sake in the shop that's actually 21% alcohol. That's the highest I've ever seen for, you know, a sake.
Right. So that means the more intense flavors, concentrated flavors too.
It does indeed, and it's in the intent of the brewer is not just to create a higher alcohol sake. The reason a sake would be made in a genshu form would be because all the other components in the sake allow it to still be very balanced even with a higher alcohol level. So that means probably, as you were saying, stronger flavors, more vibrant flavors. Maybe it's an unpasteurized sake that, you know, has enzymes still active from fermentation that give it a vibrancy or a brashness that, you know, that can kind of withstand the higher alcohol level.
Right. So the genshu, do you think you can drink it on the rock or just by itself?
I've seen certain sake sold that way, but I don't. I mean, yeah, if you want to, but I would say just drink it by itself and enjoy it for the way the brewer meant it to be enjoyed.
Don't mess with it. Then just drink it. Right. Okay. And so now, food pairings. What's your suggestion? Like, do you have any general rules?
I think it's sort of. You know, in Japan, I don't think only recently has this idea of food pairing kind of taken root, I think, because I think historically and traditionally, sake was such a regionalized or localized beverage that people drank and ate, drank the sake that was produced in their own area, and it went perfectly with the food there because that was produced in their own area too. So they tended to go together, and there was no need to kind of think about it. But as things have become more available from different parts of the country in Japan, and of course in this in here where we get foods and ingredients and beverages from all over the world, there's much more attention paid to this. But I would say, you know, for the most part, you would drink, you know, as you would imagine, lighter beverages with lighter foods and richer beverages with richer foods. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of similarities.
Right. But so lighter means that the grain is more milled down. So ginjo, dai ginjo, and the lighter food versus junmai or honjozo, a little heavier.
With the richer food. And then, of course, there's the idea of salt and sweet kind of combinations too. So if you have a sweeter sake, maybe you want to drink that with a saltier dish.
Like what kind of?
Oh, if you have, you know, some of the unpasteurized sake can be sweet, and then you might drink them with, you know, with maybe a Southeast Asian sort of food, which has a little bit, you know, tends to use fish sauce, which has a little
right. Good
saltier.
Malaysian or Vietnamese.
Yeah, or, you know, even Thai if it's not too spicy, but there are certain, you know, if you have a really strong, bold Namagenshu sake that has a lot of fruity quality to it, you could drink that with like a spicy Thai dish.
Right. Oh, and also nigori, that's unpasteurized. That's the.
Well, it's actually what people refer to as unfiltered, but nigori is, you know, it's cloudy, of course, but nigori sake also has kind of a sweetness, and then and its texture actually, you know, kind of helps because it's got the rice solids left in it. So that texture of nigori sake can stand up to some of those, you know, those spicier foods or those, you know, fiery things.
Right. Okay. And recently I had a little cheese class with sake pairings with the French Cheese Board, which is a French cheese trade organization. And we did a junmai and the mimolet, and the combination created butterscotch flavor, which never appeared in, you know, each single one of them.
Mm.
So, yeah, this sake is very subtle compared to, you know, big tannin in grapes or things like that. And it was surprising. I think sake is more forgiving. You can't miserably fail pairings.
That's right. I think I would agree with that 100%. And it's, and I think a lot of people are, you know, to your point about cheese, a lot of people are really astounded by the fact that sake goes so well with cheese, or to hear it, they're astounded. But then once you try it, I mean, and it's usually the creamier cheeses that tend to pair up real nicely with things like the Yamahai and Kimoto sake I was talking about before. But then, you know, some of the fruitier sake can pair well with, you know, some lighter flavored things, or if you have a really bold, you know, Namagenshu again, that, you know, with the Parmesan Reggiano, the you know, the saltier cheeses like that. So it's a fun thing to delve into, and I'm glad to hear that the French cheese board and and sake folks are getting together.
Yeah, we just tried and then worked out. So I think it's. You never know what kind of things work with sake. And I think American people are more creative in terms of, you know, trying things, new things.
Like. It's the exploration, you know, that's the fun of it all. And you know, there's a little bit of a hesitation at first, I think, because people, you know, they want to make sure they get something that they're going to like. But I think the more you delve into it, the more you'll find that you like a lot of different things.
Right. So in terms of vessels, what kind of glass or cups do you recommend?
Well, you know, there's a number of ways to go about it, but I always recommend, actually, if you're just drinking at home, I suggest, you know, a wine glass, a white wine glass, because it's tapered usually, and it has, that way you can be sure to get the benefit of the flavors and the aromatic qualities of the sake.
Mm.
But there's a great deal of fun and tradition involved in the customary way of drinking with the ochoko, the small cups, or with small sake glasses, because the tradition of pouring for each other in Japan and showing, you know, companionship and hospitality and generosity and being together and, you know, that with the small cups, you pour more often. So you're showing more of that, you know, that enjoyment of being, you know, together in a warm, you know, companionship sort of situation.
Right. And lastly, the temperature. So that's generally speaking, it's about white wine, the same, like 40, 44 Fahrenheit?
Yeah, we say it's very easy to drink all the premium sake that we sell, at least, you know, slightly chilled. But there are also, of course, a number of them that can be drunk at a variety of temperatures. There are certain sake, premium sake again, that can be drunk warmed as well as chilled, or warmed room temperature and chilled. So it's fun to experiment and try them, you know. But those tend to be the things that are not so much the complex Junmai Ginjo and Junmai Daiginjo or Daiginjo sake. They tend to be the Junmai and the Honjozo that you can do that with. Or usually the rule of thumb for warming things is if they're either very on the dry side or on the bold flavored side, those you can warm. But if they're fruity or on the sweet side, you don't want to warm, or complex, you don't want to warm them.
Great. All right. So thank you for joining us today, Rick. And I'll see you soon at Sakaya.
I'll look forward to Akiko-san. Arigatou gozaimashita.
Thank you. And for listeners, if you'd like to know more about Rick's store, please visit www.sakayanyc.com. That's SAKAYANYC.com. And if you have any questions or comments, please contact us at heritageradionetwork.org. And you can also reach me at akikokatayama.com. Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.